From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Yesterday, the Obama administration formally rolled out plans for a big new initiative to map the human brain, a $100 million scientific campaign to light up, pin down our neural networks. If successful, the project could lead to advancements in the treatment of Alzheimer's, autism, Parkinson's, traumatic brain injury, epilepsy, and much more. But it is a giant challenge. We actually know so little about the brain, the very seat of our intelligence. This hour on Point, mapping the human brain. You can join the conversation. Is this the final frontier? Right between our ears, are you for the investment in mapping the brain? Can we figure out how it really works? Can we do it? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. In his State of the Union address back in February, President Obama first gave a nod, a hint of the direction he was headed. Let's listen back.
Today, our scientists are mapping the human brain to unlock the answers to Alzheimer's. They're developing drugs to regenerate damaged organs, devising new materials to make batteries 10 times more powerful. Now is not the time to gut these job-creating investments in science and innovation. Now is the time to reach a level of research and development not seen since the height of the space race. We need to make those investments.
President Obama in the State of the Union address. In just a moment, we'll talk with a member of the Dream Team that is heading up the New Brain Initiative and one of the key centers that will be involved in the research. But let's go to Washington first for a little background here. Reed Epstein is with us, White House correspondent for Politico. Hi, Reed. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Great to talk to you.
$100 million over what period? First year? 10 years? What is it?
It's a period of time, and like a lot of things that the president and the White House announced, it's sort of money that hasn't yet been allocated. It's money that he's going to propose in his 2014 budget. But many of these projects have started already because they have, the agencies like the NIH and the National Science Foundation have a lot of discretion within their own budgets to spend some of this money. So while the president announced it as a new initiative, some of it has already started, the White House told me.
The NIH, National Institutes of Health, and National Science Foundation, DARPA, has a big role in this as well. That's the defense research arm. What's the Pentagon's interest in this, Reed?
Like other agencies of the government, the Pentagon is interested in knowing how the brain works. There's obviously a lot of brain injuries that come from fighting foreign wars, and the Pentagon certainly has a vested interest in knowing, how the brain works and how to fix it when people have problems with it.
The president back in February in the State of the Union talking about this as sort of a new moon landing equivalent. Is it a done deal given that there's already money allocated to a lot of these agencies? Does he need Congress to specifically sign off on this in his 2014 budget for it to get off the ground?
He doesn't need Congress to specifically sign off on it, but it's something that he's going to use to try to sell his 2014 budget. It's going to be, in the past we've seen the president propose things that Congress hasn't necessarily agreed with, and he's used it almost as a wedge to show people what he's fighting for and why it's important that the government spend money that it's raising in taxes from people.
So this is the Obama theme we hear of investment for the economy, for the future. He has said in the past, looking back to the human genome mapping, that it returned $140 to the U.S. economy for every dollar invested in that huge project.
That's right, and he's going to make the same type of argument with this. And we've even seen some Republican buy-in already. Eric Cantor, the House Majority Leader, said this is exactly the type of funding the government should be, the type of research the government should be funding. But it came with a caveat where he said that he would only agree to paying for this type of new research if the government finds corresponding cuts elsewhere. And that's really the rub for the White House, is that it doesn't want to be pitting brain research against other types of research. It wants to do both, and that's not really where Republicans are at the moment. They're not interested in spending new money, but they would sign off on something like this if the White House can find cuts elsewhere. And that's really where the fight is going to be down the road, is you're going to see the White House saying that Republicans won't agree to spend money on projects they think should go forward without laying out the caveat that Republicans are presenting.
So watch this space. The debate over the spending not over, but the push seems to be on for the brain mapping. Reid Epstein with Politico in Washington covering the White House. Thanks so much for joining us, Reid.
Thank you, Tom.
We're going to go to a couple of big scientists in the brain world, but first, the president yesterday rolling out the new initiative proposing the BRAIN Initiative, a scientific effort to map the activity of the human brain.
There's this enormous mystery waiting to be unlocked. And the BRAIN Initiative will change that by giving scientists the tools they need to get a dynamic picture of the brain in action and better understand how we think and how we learn and how we remember.
And yesterday at the White House, Dr. Francis Collins, director of the National Institutes of Health, defending the expense of the new initiative in Hard Economic Times.
Some may ask how we can afford to talk about investing in bold new research during difficult budgetary times. But the reality is, we can't afford not to. The worst thing we can do in challenging economic times is to stifle innovative thinking.
There, Francis Collins defending the new BRAIN Project, acronym for Brain Research Through Advancing Innovative Neurotechnologies, BRAIN for short. Let's go to a couple of big players in this field. With us from Providence, Rhode Island, John Donahue joins us, professor of neuroscience at Brown University. He's on the so-called Dream Team Advisory Committee for the BRAIN Initiative. He was in Washington yesterday for the president's announcement. John Donahue, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. Also with us from Seattle, Christoph Koch, neuroscientist and chief scientific officer at the Allen Institute for Brain Science, brainchild of Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen, and one of the big private sector partners in President Obama's BRAIN Initiative. Christoph Koch, welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, Tom.
John, let me come first to you. Can you define for us what is the goal here? This is to build the tools to go in and figure out the brain? Is it to actually figure out the brain? How do you describe the goal?
Well, as you pointed out, there's a dream team, and the dream team is going to come up with the specific goals. But the goals that have been proposed now are to really understand the function of the human brain. And the first step in doing that is to have the tools necessary to be able to answer a whole range of questions that we can't answer now.
And what kind of tools do we need? I mean, are we in touch with what's going on in there? Or are we in the dark at the moment? Where do we stand? What do we need?
Well, in my view, I think we have fantastic tools for studying the very micro-scale function of the brain, the level of single cells and their genes and molecules that operate them. And we also have great tools to sort of look at the big picture of the brain, the MRI images that you see all the time of where various activities are going with little colored maps. But all the interesting action happens in the middle, where large numbers of neurons are interacting with each other, talking to each other. And we don't have the tools to study them with the right resolution in time or the right coverage of the brain. And so those are the kinds of tools that are the first step in this process.
Christoph Koch in Seattle, we've mapped the human genome, and that is sort of mind-boggling enough in its own right. But somehow it seems almost, correct me if I'm wrong, it seems almost simple compared to the brain. The brain seems so elastic, so plastic, so networked. Is it really possible to map the entire human brain and understand its activity, Christoph?
Ultimately, yes, but as you pointed out, the Human Genome Project was a much easier project, challenging though as it was, because it had a very clear aim. The aim was to write down every single letter in the alphabet that makes up our genome. And so once you do that, then you can declare victory. Although, of course, we still don't understand, genetic diseases, etc., on the background of the Human Genome Project. Understanding the brain is a vastly more difficult problem. We're not even quite sure what it means to understand the brain. Does it mean we can fix it? Does it mean we can record and listen into every single nerve cell in the brain? And so those are the type of questions we are all seeking answers to, in particular by developing neurotechnology, as this new BRAIN Initiative is meant to.
John, is your understanding that we're out here to figure out how we think, how we perceive, how we dream, how we store and retrieve memories? Is that all on the table here, John?
Yes, I think it's these interesting cognitive functions, what we call higher brain functions, that are all the most mysterious aspects of what happens in the brain, and that's really what we want to go after, and what I think we haven't really had the tools to study yet.
And is it clear that understanding those things, the activity of the brain, is right up against what's needed to be learned to cure brain problems, autism, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's? Are these on the same path?
Well, I don't, we have to look at it. Are we trying to cure them? I think some of these diseases happen at the cell level, and there are many efforts going on to study the causes of these diseases. But really what we think is that disorders like schizophrenia, depression, or autism also manifest themselves in the way neurons interact with each other in large-scale networks. And so by this understanding, by the knowledge we'll get from the Brain Project, we can get an understanding of how these problems emerge, disorders of thought, say, in schizophrenia. Just like in Parkinson's disease, we don't really understand the root causes of why we have a disorder of movement in Parkinson's disease. People are rigid. Mm-hmm. But we can balance the circuits with electrical stimulation and cover up the symptoms and treat people with Parkinson's disease so they can recover their function, they can actually move again because of the technologies that are available in that disorder.
Why, tell you why, the ocean's near the shore. I could think of things I never thought before, and then I'd sit and think some more. I would not be just a nuffin, my head all full of stuffin, my heart all full of pain. I would dance and be merry, life would be a ding-a-dairy if I only had a brain.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about President Obama's big push to map the human brain, what looks possible and what the payoffs might be. At the White House yesterday, the president said he will submit the proposed $100 million in funding for the initiative as part of his budget next week.
In the budget I will send to Congress next week, I will propose a significant investment by the National Institutes of Health, DARPA, and the National Science Foundation to help get this project off the ground. I'm directing my Bioethics Commission to make sure all of the research is being done in a responsible way. And we're also partnering with the private sector.
And the payoffs, he said, not just in our understanding of the brain, but should be real economic benefits as well.
Founders of Google got their early support from the National Science Foundation. The Apollo project that put a man on the moon also gave us eventually CAT scans. And every dollar we spend to map the human genome has returned $140 to our economy. $1 of investment, $140 in return.
That sounds like a nice return. We're joined today by John Donahue, professor of neuroscience at Brown University, on the so-called Dream Team, advising on the Brain Initiative. Joins us from Providence, Rhode Island. And from Seattle, Christoph Koch is with us. He's a neuroscientist, chief scientific officer at the Allen Institute for Brain Science, one of the big private sector partners in the Brain Initiative. John Donahue, there's a lot of debate out there about whether or not this is the best way to go about studying the brain, marshaling huge resources like this, $100 million to begin with, and maybe more, much more down the road. How do you see the first steps here? Here we're pushing money at it, but you say you're still defining what should even be done. Give us some of the conceptual thinking that's going on in the boiler room here.
Well, I think that the idea of the Big Brain Initiative has precipitated a lot of discussion. And the committee that has been put together by the NIH includes even some of the skeptics about this big brain approach. So we're going to meet to say what are the tractable early-term milestones, what are things that can be done in the midterm, and what can be done in the long term. So the first step, as I think we've talked about, is to develop tools that will allow us to explore the brain in ways that we can't do now, to be able to record many neurons, pick up their activity at very high detail, and understand how they're communicating with each other. And that will be done to some extent in very simple model animals, but it's even being done to some extent in humans.
Your colleague on the Dream Team, heading it up, William Newsom at Stanford, says we're going to have to develop new technology here, new theoretical approaches, new mathematics, new computer science. In order to accomplish this, what's the skills gap we have in addressing this challenge currently, John?
Well, that of course, being able to pick up lots of neural activity over many, many neurons is going to present us with enormous amounts of data. And the most important part of the project is to understand what's going on. So what Bill Newsom is talking about is identifying techniques to explore this massive pattern of activity and try to make sense of it. And so this will require close cooperation with computational neuroscientists, with mathematicians, who understand how you can explore and discover what's going on as lots of neurons go together. Much like you can think of it as, you know, that lots of interesting activities emerge as many musical instruments play together.
Christoph Koch, help us put this in your words here. You know, describe again exactly what it is that we'll be mapping as we move forward here. And so, A, and B, if you can lay out that map, and it's sort of mind-boggling to think of the what must be billions, trillions of neural connections in there, does it necessarily follow that we'll understand what's going on? Is it as straightforward as the genome in that way?
No, it's not as straightforward, but it's the only way we can do it. So the mind is what the brain does. The brain analyzes the mind, analyzes every one of your thoughts, your conscious perception, your memories. It's all generated by literally billions of neurons interacting with each other. We understand the way they talk to each other. They have these little electrical pulses, and you can put them on audio speaker and you can listen to them. But now we have literally billions of them chattering away. And we don't understand their language. So this is a gap you previously alluded to. Even if we could record from every one of these 100 billion neurons in the human brain, we still are very far away from trying to decipher what does it mean and what does it mean for the individual concerned. Because to the individual, this chattering of nerve cells translate into seeing mom or remembering, you know, that he has to do his taxes tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And so the challenge is to try to map as much as possible of the nervous system at the level of individual neurons and then decoding it and then translating it back into meaningful action for the brain.
Our listeners are paying close attention, writing online. Vicky says it's about time. Mark says it's the new moon landing in my book, bigger really. Rick says, you know, there's a little humor here too, a whole new Google Map app here. And Chad says, hopefully they'll be able to explain how songs we don't like get stuck in our head all day. Who knows what we'll figure out from this. Manuel says, I hope they find a cure for epilepsy so my brother can finally live a normal life. I can imagine many yearning for those things. Let's go to our listeners. Ellen in Brookline, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Ellen.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'd be more than interested in this because, see, I was born with temporal lobe dysfunction. If you know anything about the brain, it's the temporal lobe that governs, like, how you logically figure things out,
yep.
How you control your emotions, how you're able to, you know, have any type of sense of directions, solve algebra word problems, whatever. I mean, to give you an idea of how I was affected, for example, I lived all my life in South Brookline. 25 years ago, I moved to North Brookline. When I moved, I was so disgusted with myself because it took me a whole month and a half just to learn my way around my own neighborhood.
Because of that temporal lobe dysfunction, does this make you hopeful, Ellen? Do you imagine that in you or in a future generation that might be fixed?
Well, I know it was genetic. How I had the problem in the first place. I could trace it to my uncle on my paternal grandfather's side.
Yeah, Ellen, let us pick it up and see if this is the kind of thing that might be addressed. John Donahue, what are you thinking as Ellen describes that affliction she's had to deal with?
Sure. Well, if we truly understand how the brain works, we ought to be able to engineer devices that can copy brain function. So one of our hopes is that we really can make replacement parts for the nervous system so that if someone is paralyzed or has a memory disorder, we can actually produce devices that can rewire the brain and allow that part of the brain to either communicate with other parts of the brain or to function again. And restore normal everyday life so that getting lost in your new neighborhood won't happen.
That sounds great for people up against it there. Christoph, we also have listeners, though, listening skeptically here. I mean, even if they agree scientifically, Bara writes to us, if the best-case scenario occurs and we can fully understand the mechanism of thought and the overall function of the brain, could we simulate it? And if so, will that simulation have the human equivalent of consciousness. This may be running way out in front of the cart, cart in front of the horse, but what about it, Christoph?
Yes, so there is a very large project funded to the order of $1.4 billion over the next 10 years by the European Union, whose goal it is to simulate the brain, including simulating ultimately the human brain. In principle, it's entirely possible. In practice, it remains to be seen how much we can actually achieve of that over the next 5 to 10 years. It remains a completely open question, a very, very interesting question. To what extent, if you have an accurate simulation of the brain, to what extent that simulation also replicates the most mysterious of all brain function, that is consciousness. We're still grappling with that fundamental, this is the ancient mind-body problem, right? Mm-hmm. How does a physical system like the brain, the most complex organ in the known universe, how does such a piece of highly excitable matter, how does it generate thoughts? How does it generate pleasure, the feeling of seeing red, the fact that you remember? That still remains one of the biggest scientific challenges of all time.
So to our listener's specific question, if this project were, let's say, fabulously successful, are you imagining that we might be able to actually understand the character of consciousness and, I don't know, drop it into a computer so that the computer, too, was conscious?
Yes, once again, that is a very real possibility, that once we can understand it, we can emulate it, we can simulate it, and we can also imbue other systems that we build, i.e. like computers or like robots, with some sort of artificial consciousness. This is a question, incidentally, that's being debated in the field.
And with that, we see why President Obama was careful to point out that there would be also ethical consideration here as this whole project moves forward. Lawrence in Charlotte, North Carolina. Lawrence, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
First of all, the first caller, I can appreciate her situation. Having been trained in neurophysiology and neurosurgery, we used to do brain mapping for epilepsy surgery.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a couple comments and a question. The brain is more than just neurons, neural circuits, oscillators. It's chemical and electrical transmission. It's glia, oligodendroglia, you know, ependymal cells, fluid, CSF, cerebrospinal fluid, and, you know, a host of other factors,
yes,
including neurohumoral factors and sensory inputs. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I wanted the panel to comment on if that's going to be part of the study, but I also wanted to state that I think that they would be needing set theory and quantum statistical methods to actually integrate all of these various factors. And the last point was that the Dalai Lama actually has been convening mind-body panels for many, many years dealing with these subjects of the mind and body with very sophisticated scientific panels.
So there may be many approaches to this. Let us pick it up. John Donahue, our doctor in Charlotte, has done research himself. And what about his scientific question there? I mean, we read a lot about neural networks and neural code in regard to this project, but he points out it's a vast array of things involved, oscillators and ganglia, chemicals, and, you know, are you going after everything, or does the map mean it's just the neural network that's your focus?
Well, we are aware as biologists that the neurons live in a milieu or an environment of all of these chemicals that modulate the activity, and glial cells, which are supporting cells but also influence the way the neurons work. So these will all have to be taken into account as we look at this, the overall interaction of the brain, and that's what makes it such a complex and challenging problem.
Does that make it, the mapping the human genome took, a decade?
10 years.
Ten years. Is this imaginably doable in that kind of period of time, Christoph, or not?
No, it's a vastly more complicated problem. It will take longer than just a single decade to understand the human brain, which is, after all, with its 100 billion nerve cells and 100 billion roughly glia cells, by far the most complex organ in the known universe. But, you know, a voyage of 1,000 miles starts with one step. So this is the next logical progression. We need to be able to intervene more in the brain. We need to be able to record from larger fractions of its nerve cells, and this is the right way to proceed.
Joel in Nashville, Tennessee. Joel, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm just listening to this conversation, and I can't help but think about the movie The Matrix, when people are, you know, plugging these things into the back of their skulls and they could just learn anything, like, for example, how to fly a helicopter just at a whim, you know.
Yep.
And I'm wondering if that's even a possibility that we can look forward to in the future, and how much this is going to change how we learn anything.
Joel, thanks for your call. John Donahue, what do you say?
Well, I think, you know, in the Matrix, they could write in information into the brain pretty effectively. I don't think any of us know exactly how that could happen, because we would have to go after the trillion connections in the brain and try to address each one of them. So in the Brain Initiative, we'll be trying to get better ways to interact with the brain, but I think the scale of what happens in the Matrix is very far off, if maybe never able to happen.
Because of the complexity, and we've got more immediate challenges, I guess. Isaac in St. Louis, Missouri. Isaac, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was wanting to comment on like some of the opponents to the thing that Obama's doing. Like they're saying that we need to, you know, like fix the rest of the budget before we can spend $100 million on learning this. But the problem that I see with that is, you know, basically, like our whole national budget is enormous, and $100 million is not that much of it. You know, we definitely need to make sure that we continue our understanding of ourselves and the universe in order to further ourselves as a species.
So you say, let's go, let's do it. John Donahue, you've got a number of people writing here to us saying, Randy as well says, I'm for it, but $100 million is tiny. How do you see this $100 million first commitment that the president's making here? I mean, we've got a big budget deficit, so people are concerned about that. But in terms of what this might ultimately cost to accomplish, is that just a tiny down payment? Is that the whole thing? How's the money look in the big scheme to you?
Well, so I don't make the policy to generate the money, but I do think this is a good start. I think the economic payoff for an investment like this can be enormous. Imagine we come up with a way to stave off the dementia that is going to occur in about 50% of our population over 85 from Alzheimer's disease. If we could slow that down for 5 or 10 years, this would have an enormous impact, and $100 million would be trivial comparatively.
I mean, you'd have to get busy, though. I mean, the boomers who are now heading into that danger zone are already turning 60-plus.
That's
well,
right.
There are a total of 60,000 neuroscientists worldwide who are trying to uncover these. We're trying to, you know, study the brain in health and in disease. So it is a big business, and a lot of us are trying to help these people as quickly as we can.
Well, we're going to take a short break here. Christoph Koch in Seattle, please stand by there at the Allen Institute for Brain Science, one of the big partners in the new Brain Initiative. And John Donahue on the Dream Team helping head this up. We're going to hear in a moment from a skeptic who says maybe this huge-scale project is not the way to go. We'll hear that out. And we'll keep our sense of humor, the brain here from Young Frankenstein. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
The brain, there is nothing like the brain. Hearts and lungs are simply tinker toys when stacked against the brain. Insane, I'm insane about the brain. No invention in the universe is equal to the brain. But the brain, please allow me to explain. There's no organ can compare to it, I swear to it, it's
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about President Obama's big push to map the human brain, what looks possible, and what the payoffs might be. John Donahue is with us, neuroscientist at Brown University and one of the so-called Dream Team Advisory Committee members for the new big brain initiative rolled out at the White House yesterday. He joins us from Providence, Rhode Island. Christoph Koch is with us from the Allen Institute for Brain Science, put together by Paul Allen, one of the big founders of Microsoft. He's chief scientific officer there and joins us from Seattle. In just a moment, we're going to hear from Michael Eisen at Berkeley, who has some questions about whether or not this approach is the way to go in terms of understanding the brain. Jess responds here on Twitter, says the brain is a tiny galaxy, as many neurons as stars in the Milky Way. Sounds like a very big challenge, but we've got many others saying, let's go, let's try. Jim says, My father suffered from a unique degeneration of his mind. My grandmother suffered from Parkinson's. I know others who suffered from MS. I see elderly people whose limbs shake. I fully support the president's $100 million initiative. John Donahue, Christoph Koch, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Berkeley, California, Michael Eisen. He's a biologist, professor of biology at the University of California, Berkeley, investigator at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, where this is a big subject. Michael Eisen, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
What's your concern about this big science, big project approach to understanding the brain, Michael?
I think we all are in favor of studying the brain. I think it's an amazingly fascinating problem, and there's both practical and philosophical reasons to try to understand how the brain works, how the human brain works, and how we can intervene in diseases. But the real question that I haven't heard asked here is whether this is the right approach to go after it. We're talking about initial investment of $100 million with more to come in the future, to be organized and run out of a committee in Washington. No matter how fabulous the dream team is, and it really is a dream team from the view of scientists. Mm-hmm. If we look back at the history of scientific innovation in this country, the major innovations, the major things that have won America more Nobel Prizes than any other country, have been independent individual scientists pursuing their ideas, backed by the federal government, giving them the money to do what they want to do and to pursue their creativity, but not being told by Washington what the problems that they should be working on and how they should be going after them. And what I'm really worried about is that, when you put a bunch of people in a room, no matter how smart and intelligent they are, what you end up with is a kind of consensus view of what the right science to do is. And science doesn't proceed well by consensus. It proceeds by people challenging paradigms, by people coming up with new ideas. And I think, especially at a time when independent scientists out in the field are starving for grant money, it's impossible to get funded these days. People are leaving the field in droves because they can't get money. The notion that we should sort of circle the wagons and put this huge bet on one program, one particular way to pursue this problem, I think this is actually a recipe for holding back progress in neuroscience and in brain research. And so I'd really think that we should be, the president and the NIH and others should be defending what works in American science, investment in basic research, investment in basic researchers, and recognizing that no matter how important the problem is, trying to direct how it's gonna proceed from Washington is just not the way that science has proceeded in this country and has worked for the last century.
Michael, let me ask you, some people will be listening and I mean, that's a very American kind of appeal. People will understand exactly what you're saying, but then they look at the Human Genome Project. It was very big money. It was 10 years and boom, then we had the genome. And people may say, well, look, it worked there. Why not here, Michael?
Right. The Human Genome Project was a very specific thing. We knew exactly what we wanted to do. We wanted to sequence the 3 billion nucleotides in the human genome. And we even had, basically the technology was already in place to do that. What needed to happen with the Human Genome Project was to take that technology and scale it, do it more efficiently, at a bigger scale and more cheaply. It was essentially the industrialization of an already existing technology. And it was great. The genome centers and the investment in the Human Genome Project allowed us to go from something that was too expensive and too cumbersome to do at the start to something that worked within a decade. But this is not that type of problem. I mean, if you talk to any neuroscience, we don't even know exactly what we want to measure. Is it the activity of brains? Is it the chemical patterns in different neurons? Is it the different structures of the brain? This is a field in which we're still trying to figure out what questions we should be asking, let alone what the technology to do it is. This is not a field where we have a technology that's just awaiting scaling and industrialization. So it really, the Human Genome Project is not the right model. This is a completely different kind of endeavor. And I think the fact that the people in Washington are continuing to use the Human Genome Project as a model for this represents a deep misunderstanding about the differences between these fields and what it takes to really innovate in science as opposed to industrialize science.
Let's pick up this challenge. John Donahue, you're on the, you know, this is right in your wheelhouse. You're on the Dream Team Steering Committee here. What about this conceptual challenge to this approach that you hear Michael Eisen making?
So what Michael has just said is the main reason why I'm so excited that this is a BRAIN initiative, because there is no plan to exactly how to allocate the money. In fact, the first part of all of this is to have exactly this discussion. What are the big questions? What are the addressable questions? And I think the dialogue that has been precipitated by the announcement of this initiative is a very important mechanism to focus our research and to stimulate those people who are the independent investigators. Now, as far as I understand that the committee we're on, that there is no first thing we're going to do is reach out to a very broad community and try to come up with ways of presenting and focusing the very big questions. And secondly, what we're going to do is be very open to the kinds of mechanisms. And I also am a very strong supporter of individual investigator grants. And at a time when these resources are diminishing and very bright people aren't coming into the field, I see this as a way to increase the number of those grants. Now, the other thing that this approach could do would be to say, as a consequence of one of the things we're limited in doing is we don't have the national resources, perhaps a national lab that can provide very complex technology that can allow us to allow independent investigators to address questions they can not now investigate. So we are really at the cusp of really great advances, and we need a way to focus it and stimulate it, and I think that's exactly what this initiative will do, and it will address, I think, all of the questions that Michael has raised.
Michael, why are you concerned that this might hold back individual, independent effort rather than sort of marshal funds that would be distributed and nourish it?
Because we've seen it before. I mean, the in the decade plus since the Human Genome Project was completed, you know, every couple of years, the NIH and other federal agencies come out with some, you know, human genome project for understanding cancer, human genome project for understanding the function of the genome. And they all start with this same kind of, you know, open, this open attitude that we're going to involve the community, we're going to support individual investigators. And what inevitably happens when you have so much invested at the, you know, so much of the, you know, President Obama, the leaders of the NIH are all invested in this project in a very public way, it inevitably leads to more centralized control over what people are going to do, and it just hasn't worked in the way that we fund science. We've seen a decade of these projects that are supposed to be the next Human Genome Project, and yet, you know, in my opinion, none of them have been successful, and we keep on hearkening back to the Genome Project as our great model, mm-hmm. and nobody's talking about these human genome projects for all these other fields that have happened. You know, I hope that he's right, that what we're really seeing here is just a way of supporting more independent neuroscience research and encouraging people to come into the field. But I think experience has told us that what's more likely to happen is that you're going to have a bureaucracy built up in Washington that's invested in doing this in a particular kind of way. You have a project that becomes in every way too big to fail because so much is invested in it in a political sense that you start to exert more control over what individual researchers are going to do. You start to steer the project from the central sort of a central committee, and it just doesn't work. And as much as it is appealing to try to do these gigantic projects, I would just love to see someone in, you know, President Obama or Francis Collins or someone else just stand up and say, look, the way we get progress in these fields is just to continue supporting and funding independent researchers. That works. They will come up with the new ideas. They'll come up with the things that drive us forward. And what we should be doing is investing in them to a greater extent rather than trying to decide what they're going to be working on in a centralized way.
Michael Eisen, I appreciate you raising this note of caution as this gets up on the rails here today out of UC Berkeley. Michael Eisen, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Christoph Koch, you're the closest thing we have to a third party here. You didn't have to join this effort, but you have at the Allen Institute. What about Michael's concerns?
Well, I mean, one should say that this is a small down payment on something much larger, right? I mean, the total cost is $100 million. If you compare that against the cost of a single F-2 stealth fighter, which is $150 million, mm-hmm. and we have roughly 200 of them.
Wow.
It's a relative, you know, small first down payment on a larger future. B. S. John has pointed out this is really a committee that sets up sort of a broad idea. Ultimately, this committee will lead to a set of announcement where everybody, every scientist in the States can apply for funding, no matter how out there ideas are there. But ultimately, it's for people. It's a focused effort for people to help us develop further technology that we need, that we desperately need to study the brain. We need to listen into the neurons in order to understand. And the problem is, as John alluded to earlier in our conversation, that right now we can only listen to a very small number of nerve cells. So we really need more technology to be able to listen to 10,000, 100,000, or a million of the nerve cells. And I'd like to remind you that there are 100 billion of them that make up your or my brain. So So that's really the missing gap, and having made money available specifically to develop such technology, I think it's exactly the right way to go.
Elizabeth in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Elizabeth, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to talk about the fact that 22 years ago I had a stroke. I was very young, mm-hmm. and at that time, the concept of neuroplasticity was, it seems, barely known, and it certainly wasn't integrated into my care and my rehabilitation. Mm-hmm. That shows you how much things have changed. I know that rehab techniques now for people who have brain injuries, strokes, it really has much more. There are many more possibilities because of the understanding of neuroplasticity.
So our conceptual understanding really matters. Elizabeth, forgive me, but our time is short, and I want to hear John Donahue on exactly the point you raise, Elizabeth. This tremendous plasticity of the human brain, John, everybody understands it at this point. I mean, broadly speaking. But I can't help wondering, as Elizabeth raises that, is something so plastic that can reshape and reshape and reshape, is it really mappable? Given how plastic that is, changeable it is.
Sure, it's like the weather. You know, the weather's always changing, but we can map that. So the brain, this is the exciting thing, is our brain is ever-changing, and what we need to understand is the rules by which a population of neurons in one part of your brain is communicating with some other area, and then it switches very quickly. This is probably how, when we're coming up with conversations and ideas, that we can come up with new ideas, because these things are changing at all the time. So I think this is the very essence of what we want to understand, and I think it is understandable.
Even though it's so fluid.
Exactly. As I said, it's like the weather. The weather's fluid, but we can make some predictions about what's going to happen in the short, very short and very long term.
Michael in Boston. You're on the air, Michael.
Hi, Tom. Over the past couple of years, a lot of money has been spent by government and marketers to use techniques that are generally called big data to try to determine things about the marketplace, for that matter, Baghdad, based on the small activities of millions or billions of actors. And I'm wondering if people are talking about using or adapting big data techniques to this sort of neural parsing they're talking about.
Christoph Koch, is there a relevant dialogue there?
Yeah, because this project and other projects like it will generate terabytes of data. So we have these large volumes of data streaming in from all these instruments that map the brain. So there's a significant effort of people involving from computer science, from informatics, from genomics that are used to dealing with big data to analyze this data, display it, and finally understand it. Because the biggest challenge of all is, even if we could record from every single nerve cell in the human brain, is to actually understand it, what it means. How does the concerted activity of a billion or 100 billion nerve cells give rise to perception and to memory? So yes, this requires significant informatics effort.
John, down the road, we heard our caller from Charlotte, North Carolina earlier, the doctor calling in talking about the Dalai Lama studying the mind-body connection. You can hear people rooting you on here. You can hear notes of skepticism. And then there are those who I can well imagine wondering if ultimately we're dealing with things so elusive that they're not traceable here, that there's something about the mind-body connection, consciousness itself, that could elude science. What about that, John?
That's a very open-ended question, but I think as a scientist, we believe that all of these processes are manifest in some biological physical system that we can, by systematic scientific inquiry, understand. And I think Christoph is a real, maybe the greatest expert on consciousness now, and that is probably the most elusive. And I think scientists are you know, dance around the fringes of whether or not we can ever get to understanding consciousness.
You think we can pin it down, Christoph, ultimately?
It's very interesting. I just spent a week, in fact, with His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and as the caller said, he's very interested in linking Western science, Western brain science, with Eastern concepts of mind and mind-body. And yes, he too believes that ultimately the way to understand consciousness is through rational inquiry of the sort that we do here using science.
Well, we may be off on a big new campaign on exactly that front. Christoph Koch at the Allen Institute for Brain Science, joining us today from Seattle. Good luck to you, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
And John Donahue at Brown University on the advisory Dream Team, steering the Brain Initiative, announced at the White House yesterday. John Donahue, thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure.
Tomorrow, David Stockman will be with us. He was Ronald Reagan's budget director. He's out with a big new cry that's saying crony capitalism is derailing the U.S. economy and that we are in big trouble. David Stockman will be with us tomorrow. Hope you'll join us. Thanks for being here today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.